Chapter 5. The Ghost of Captain Brand. It is not so easy to tell why discredit should be cast upon a man, because of something that his grandfather may have done amiss, but the world, which is never over nice in its discrimination, as to where to lay the blame, is often pleased to make the innocent suffer in the place of the guilty. Barnaby True was a good, honest, biddable lad, as boys go, but yet he was not ever allowed altogether to forget that his grandfather had been that very famous pirate, Captain William Brand, who, after so many marvelous adventures, if one may believe the catchpenny stories and ballads that were written about him, was murdered in Jamaica by Captain John Malyoe, the commander of his own consort, the Adventure Galley. It has never been denied, that ever I heard, that up to the time of Captain Brand's being commissioned against the South Sea pirates he had always been esteemed as honest, reputable a sea captain as could be. When he started out upon that adventure it was with a ship, the Royal Sovereign, fitted out by some of the most decent merchants of New York. The governor himself had subscribed to the adventure, and had himself signed Captain Brand's commission. So, if the unfortunate man went astray, he must have had great temptation to do so, many others behaving no better, when the opportunity offered in those faraway seas where so many rich purchases might very easily be taken, and no one the wiser. To be sure, those stories and ballads made our captain to be a most wicked, profane wretch. And if he were, why, God knows he suffered and paid for it, for he laid his bones in Jamaica, and never saw his home or his wife and daughter again, after he had sailed away on the Royal Sovereign on that long misfortunate voyage, leaving them in New York to the care of strangers. At the time when he met his fate in Port Royal Harbor he had obtained two vessels under his command, the Royal Sovereign, which was the boat fitted out for him in New York, and the Adventure Galley, which he was said to have taken somewhere in the South Seas. With these he lay in those waters of Jamaica for over a month after his return from the coasts of Africa, waiting for news from home, which, when it came, was of the very blackest. For the colonial authorities were at that time stirred up very hot against him to take him, and hang him for a pirate, so as to clear their own skirts for having to do with such a fellow. So maybe it seemed better to our captain to hide his ill-gotten treasure there in those far dash-away parts, and afterward to try and bargain with it for his life, when he should reach New York, rather than to sail straight for the Americas with what he had earned by his piracies, and so risk losing life and money both. However that might be, the story was that Captain Brand and his gunner, and Captain Malyoe of the Adventure, and the sailing master of the Adventure all went ashore together with a chest of money, no one of them choosing to trust the other three in so nice an affair, and buried the treasure somewhere on the beach of Port Royal Harbor. The story then has it, that they fell a-quarreling about a future division of the money, and that, as a wind-up to the affair, Captain Malyoe shot Captain Brand through the head, while the sailing master of the Adventure served the gunner of the Royal Sovereign after the same fashion through the body, and that the murderers then went away, leaving the two stretched out in their own blood on the sand in the staring sun, with no one to know where the money was hid, but they two who had served their comrades so. It is a mighty great pity that anyone should have a grandfather who ended his days in such a sort as this. But it was no fault of Barnaby True's, nor could he have done anything to prevent it, seeing that he was not even born into the world at the time that his grandfather turned pirate, and was only 1 year old when he so met his tragical end. Nevertheless, the boys with whom he went to school never tired of calling him pirate, and would sometimes sing for his benefit that famous catchpenny song beginning thus. Oh, my name was Captain Brand, a sailing, and a sailing. Oh, my name was Captain Brand, a sailing free. Oh, my name was Captain Brand, and I sinned by sea and land, for I broke God's just command, a sailing free. 'Twas a vile thing, to sing at the grandson of so misfortunate a man, and oftentimes little Barnaby True would double up his fists, and would fight his tormentors at great odds, and would sometimes go back home with a bloody nose to have his poor mother cry over him, and grieve for him. Not that his days were all of teasing and torment, neither. For if his comrades did treat him so, why, then, there were other times, when he and they were as great friends as could be, and would go in swimming together, where there was a bit of sandy strand along the East River above Fort George, and that in the most amicable fashion. Or, maybe the very next day, after he had fought so with his fellows, he would go rambling with them up the Bowyer Road. Perhaps to help them steal cherries from some old Dutch farmer, forgetting in such adventure what a thief his own grandfather had been. Well, when Barnaby True was between 16 and 17 years old, he was taken into employment in the counting house of Mr. Roger Arkwright, the well-known West India merchant, and Barnaby's own stepfather. It was the kindness of this good man that not only found a place for Barnaby in the counting house, but advanced him so fast that against our hero was 21 years old, he had made 4 voyages as supercargo to the West Indies in Mr. Arkwright's ship, the Belle Helen, and soon after he was 21 undertook a 5th. Nor was it in any such subordinate position as mere supercargo that he acted, but rather as the confidential agent of Mr. Arkwright, who, having no children of his own, was very jealous to advance our hero into a position of trust and responsibility in the counting house, as though he were indeed a son, so that even the captain of the ship had scarcely more consideration aboard than he, young as he was in years. As for the agents and correspondents of Mr. Arkwright throughout these parts, they also, knowing how the good man had adopted his interests, were very polite and obliging to Master Barnaby, especially, be it mentioned, Mr. Ambrose Greenfield, of Kingston, Jamaica, who, upon the occasions of his visits to those parts, did all that he could to make Barnaby's stay in that town agreeable and pleasant to him. So much for the history of our hero to the time of the beginning of this story, without which you shall hardly be able to understand the purport of those most extraordinary adventures that befell him shortly after he came of age, nor the logic of their consequence after they had occurred. For it was during his 5th voyage to the West Indies that the first of those extraordinary adventures happened, of which I shall have presently to tell. At that time he had been in Kingston for the best part of 4 weeks, lodging at the house of a very decent, respectable widow, by name Mrs. Ann Balls, who, with 3 pleasant and agreeable daughters, kept a very clean and well-served lodging house in the outskirts of the town. One morning, as our hero sat sipping his coffee, clad only in loose cotton drawers, a shirt, and a jacket, and with slippers upon his feet, as is the custom in that country, where everyone endeavors to keep as cool as may be while he sat thus sipping his coffee, Miss Eliza, the youngest of the 3 daughters, came and gave him a note, which, she said, a stranger had just handed in at the door, going away again without waiting for a reply. You may judge of Barnaby's surprise when he opened the note and read as follows. Mr. Barnaby True. Sir, though you don't know me, I know you, and I tell you this. If you will be at Pratt's Ordinary on Harbor Street on Friday next at 8 o'clock of the evening, and will accompany the man who shall say to you, the Royal Sovereign is come in, you shall learn something the most to your advantage that ever befell you. Sir, keep this note, and show it to him who shall address these words to you, so to certify that you are the man he seeks. Such was the wording of the note, which was without address, and without any superscription whatever. The first emotion that stirred Barnaby was one of extreme and profound amazement. Then the thought came into his mind that some witty fellow, of whom he knew a good many in that town, and wild, waggish pranks they were, was attempting to play off some smart jest upon him. But all that Miss Eliza could tell him, when he questioned her concerning the messenger, was that the bearer of the note was a tall, stout man, with a red neckerchief around his neck, and copper buckles to his shoes, and that he had the appearance of a sailorman, having a great big queue hanging down his back. But, Lord! Busy seaport town, full of scores of men, to fit such a likeness. Accordingly, our hero put away the note into his wallet, determining to show it to his good friend Mr. Greenfield that evening, and to ask his advice upon it. So he did show it, and that gentleman's opinion was the same as his, that some wag was minded to play off a hoax upon him, and that the matter of the letter was all nothing but smoke. Nevertheless, though Barnaby was thus confirmed in his opinion as to the nature of the communication he had received, he yet determined in his own mind that he would see the business through to the end, and would be at Pratt's Ordinary, as the note demanded, upon the day and at the time specified there. Pratt's Ordinary was at that time a very fine and well-known place of its sort, with good tobacco and the best rum that ever I tasted, and had a garden behind it that, sloping down to the harbor front, was planted pretty thick with palms, and ferns grouped in two clusters with flowers and plants. Here were a number of little tables, some in little grottos, like our Vauxhall in New York, and with red, and blue and white paper lanterns hung among the foliage, whither gentlemen and ladies used sometimes, to go of an evening to sit, and drink lime juice and sugar and water, and sometimes a taste of something stronger, and to look out across the water at the shipping in the cool of the night. Thither, accordingly, our hero went, a little before the time appointed in the note, and passing directly through the ordinary, and the garden beyond, chose a table at the lower end of the garden, and close to the water's edge, where he would not be easily seen by anyone coming into the place. Then, ordering some rum and water and a pipe of tobacco, he composed himself to watch for the appearance of those witty fellows whom he suspected would presently come thither, to see the end of their prank, and to enjoy his confusion. The spot was pleasant enough, for the land breeze, blowing strong and full, set the leaves of the palm tree above his head to rattling and clattering continually against the sky, where, the moon then being about full, they shone every now and then like blades of steel. The waves also were splashing up against the little landing place at the foot of the garden, sounding very cool in the night, and sparkling all over the harbor, where the moon caught the edges of the water. A great many vessels were lying at anchor in their ridings, with the dark, prodigious form of a man of war looming up above them in the moonlight. There our hero sat for the best part of an hour, smoking his pipe of tobacco and sipping his grog, and seeing not so much as a single thing that might concern the note he had received. It was not far from half an hour after the time appointed in the note, when a rowboat came suddenly out of the night, and pulled up to the landing place at the foot of the garden above mentioned, and three or four men came ashore in the darkness. Without saying a word among themselves, they chose a nearby table, and, sitting down, ordered rum and water, and began drinking their grog in silence. They might have sat there about 5 minutes, when, by and by, Barnaby True became aware that they were observing him very curiously, and then almost immediately one, who was plainly the leader of the party, called out to him, "How now, messmate? Won't you come and drink a dram of rum with us?" "Why, no," says Barnaby, answering very civilly. "I have drunk enough already, and more would only heat my blood." "All the same," quoth the stranger, "I think you will come and drink with us. For, unless I am mistook, you are Mr. Barnaby True, and I am come here to tell you that the royal sovereign is come in." Now I may honestly say that Barnaby True was never more struck aback in all his life than he was at hearing these words uttered in so unexpected a manner. He had been looking to hear them under such different circumstances that, now that his ears heard them addressed to him, and that so seriously, by a perfect stranger, who, with others, had thus mysteriously come ashore out of the darkness. He could scarce believe that his ears heard aright. His heart suddenly began beating at a tremendous rate, and had he been an older and wiser man, I do believe he would have declined the adventure, instead of leaping blindly, as he did, into that of which he could see neither the beginning nor the ending. But being barely 21 years of age, and having an adventurous disposition, that would have carried him into almost anything that possessed a smack of uncertainty or danger about it, he contrived to say, in a pretty easy tone, though God knows how it was put on for the occasion, "Well, then, if that be so, and if the royal sovereign is indeed come in, why, I'll join you, since you are so kind as to ask me." And therewith he went across to the other table, carrying his pipe with him, and sat down and began smoking, with all the appearance of ease he could assume upon the occasion. "Well, Mr. Barnaby True," said the man who had before addressed him, so soon as Barnaby had settled himself, speaking in a low tone of voice, so there would be no danger of any others hearing the words, "Well, Mr. Barnaby True, for I shall call you by your name, to show you that, though I know you, you don't know me, I am glad to see that you are man enough to enter thus into an affair, though you can't see to the bottom of it. For it shows me that you are a man of mettle, and are deserving of the fortune that is to befall you tonight. Nevertheless, first of all, I am bid to say that you must show me a piece of paper that you have about you, before we go a step farther." "Very well," said Barnaby. "I have it here safe and sound, and see it you shall." And thereupon and without more ado he fetched out his wallet, opened it, and handed his interlocutor the mysterious note he had received the day or two before. Whereupon the other, drawing to him the candle, burning there for the convenience of those who would smoke tobacco, began immediately reading it. This gave Barnaby True a moment or two to look at him. He was a tall, stout man, with a red handkerchief tied around his neck, and with copper buckles on his shoes, so that Barnaby True could not but wonder whether he was not the very same man who had given the note to Miss Elizabeth at the door of his lodging house. "'Tis all right and straight as it should be," the other said, after he had so glanced his eyes over the note. "And now that the paper is read, suiting his action to his words, I'll just burn it, for safety's sake." And so he did, twisting it up and setting it to the flame of the candle. "And now," he said, continuing his address, "I'll tell you what I am here for. I was sent to ask you if you're man enough to take your life in your own hands, and to go with me in that boat down there? Say yes, and we'll start away without wasting more time, for the devil is ashore here at Jamaica, though you don't know what that means, and if he gets ahead of us, why, then we may whistle for what we are after. Say no, and I go away again, and I promise you you shall never be troubled again in this sort. So now speak up plain, young gentleman, and tell us what is your mind in this business, and whether you will adventure any farther or not." If our hero hesitated, it was not for long. I cannot say that his courage did not waver for a moment, but if it did, it was, I say, not for long, and when he spoke up it was with a voice as steady as could be. "To be sure I'm man enough to go with you," he said. "And if you mean me any harm I can look out for myself, and if I can't, why, here is something can look out for me." And therewith he lifted up the flap of his coat pocket, and showed the butt of a pistol he had fetched with him when he had set out from his lodging house that evening. At this the other burst out a-laughing. "Come," says he, "you are indeed of right mettle, and I like your spirit. All the same, no one in all the world means you less ill than I, and so, if you have to use that barker, 'twill not be upon us who are your friends, but only upon one who is more wicked than the devil himself. So come, and let us get away." Thereupon he and the others, who had not spoken a single word for all this time, rose from the table, and he having paid the scores of all, they all went down together to the boat, that still lay at the landing place at the bottom of the garden. Thus coming to it, our hero could see, that it was a large yawl boat manned with half a score of black men for rowers, and there were two lanterns in the stern sheets, and three or four iron shovels. The man who had conducted the conversation with Barnaby True for all this time, and who was, as has been said, plainly the captain of the party, stepped immediately down into the boat. Our hero followed, and the others followed after him. And instantly they were seated, the boat was shoved off, and the black men began pulling straight out into the harbor, and so, at some distance away, around under the stern of the man of war. Not a word was spoken, after they had thus left the shore, and presently they might all have been ghosts, for the silence of the party. Barnaby True was too full of his own thoughts to talk, and serious enough thoughts they were by this time, with crimps to trip and a man at every turn, and press gangs to carry a man off, so that he might never be heard of again. As for the others, they did not seem to choose to say anything now that they had him fairly embarked upon their enterprise. And so the crew pulled on in perfect silence for the best part of an hour, the leader of the expedition directing the course of the boat straight across the harbor, as though toward the mouth of the Rio Cobra River. Indeed, this was their destination, as Barnaby could after a while see, by the low point of land with a great long row of coconut palms upon it, the appearance of which he knew very well, which by and by began to loom up out of the milky dimness of the moonlight. As they approached the river they found the tide was running strong out of it, so that some distance away from the stream it gurgled and rippled alongside the boat as the crew of black men pulled strongly against it. Thus they came up under what was either a point of land, or an islet covered with a thick growth of mangrove trees. But still no one spoke a single word, as to their destination, or what was the business they had in hand. The night, now that they were close to the shore, was loud with the noise of running tide water, and the air was heavy with the smell of mud and marsh, and over all the whiteness of the moonlight, with a few stars pricking out here and there in the sky, and all so strange and silent and mysterious that Barnaby could not divest himself of the feeling that it was all a dream. So, the rowers bending to the oars, the boat came slowly around from under the clump of mangrove bushes, and out into the open water again. Instantly it did, so the leader of the expedition called out in a sharp voice, and the black men instantly lay on their oars. Almost at the same instant Barnaby True became aware that there was another boat coming down the river toward where they lay, now drifting with the strong tide out into the harbor again, and he knew that it was because of the approach of that boat that the other had called upon his men to cease rowing. The other boat, as well as he could see in the distance, was full of men, some of whom appeared to be armed. For even in the dusk of the darkness the shine of the moonlight glimmered sharply now, and then on the barrels of muskets or pistols, and in the silence that followed after their own rowing had ceased Barnaby True could hear the chug, chug, through the watery stillness of the night as the boat drew nearer and nearer. But he knew nothing of what it all meant, nor whether these others were friends or enemies, or what was to happen next. The oarsmen of the approaching boat did not for a moment cease their rowing, not till they had come pretty close to Barnaby and his companions. Then a man who sat in the stern ordered them to cease rowing, and as they lay on their oars he stood up. As they passed by, Barnaby True could see him very plain, the moonlight shining full upon him, a large, stout gentleman with a round red face, and clad in a fine laced coat of red cloth. Amidship of the boat was a boxer chest about the bigness of a middle-sized traveling trunk, but covered all over with cakes of sand and dirt. In the act of passing, the gentleman, still standing, pointed at it with an elegant gold-headed cane which he held in his hand. "Are you come after this, Abraham Dolling?" and thereat his countenance broke into as evil, malignant a grin as ever Barnaby True saw in all of his life. The other did not immediately reply, so much as a single word, but sat as still as any stone. Then, at last, the other boat having gone by, he suddenly appeared to regain his wits, for he bawled out after it, "Very well, Jack Malyoe. Very well, Jack Malyoe. You've got ahead of us this time again, but next time is the third, and then it shall be our turn, even if William Brand must come back from hell to settle with you." This he shouted out as the other boat passed farther and farther away, but to it my fine gentleman made no reply except to burst out into a great roaring fit of laughter. There was another man among the armed men in the stern of the passing boat, a villainous, lean man with lantern jaws, and the top of his head as bald as the palm of my hand. As the boat went away into the night with the tide, and the headway the oars had given it, he grinned so that the moonlight shone white on his big teeth. Then, flourishing a great big pistol, he said, and Barnaby could hear every word he spoke, "Do but give me the word, Your Honor, and I'll put another bullet through the son of a sea cook." But the gentleman said some words to forbid him, and therewith the boat was gone away into the night, and presently Barnaby could hear that the men at the oars had begun rowing again, leaving them lying there, without a single word, being said for a long time. By and by one of those in Barnaby's boat spoke up. "Where shall you go now?" he said. At this the leader of the expedition appeared suddenly, to come back to himself, and to find his voice again. "Go out. Go to the devil. Again, that's where we'll go." And therewith he fell a cursing and swearing until he foamed at the lips, as though he had gone clean crazy, while the black men began rowing back again across the harbor as fast as ever they could lay oars into the water. They put Barnaby True ashore below the old custom house. But so bewildered and shaken was he by all that had happened, and by what he had seen, and by the names that he heard spoken, that he was scarcely conscious of any of the familiar things among which he found himself thus standing. And so he walked up the moonlit street toward his lodging like one drunk or bewildered. For John Malyoe was the name of the captain of the Adventure Galley, he who had shot Barnaby's own grandfather, and Abraham Dolling was the name of the gunner of the Royal Sovereign who had been shot at the same time with the pirate captain, and who, with him, had been left stretched out in the staring sun by the murderers. The whole business had occupied hardly 2 hours, but it was as though that time was no part of Barnaby's life, but all a part of some other life, so dark and strange, and mysterious that it in no wise belonged to him. As for that box covered all over with mud, he could only guess at that time what it contained, and what the finding of it signified. But of this our hero said nothing to anyone, nor did he tell a single living soul what he had seen that night, but nursed it in his own mind, where it lay, so big for a while, that he could think of little or nothing else for days after. Mr. Greenfield, Mr. Arkwright's correspondent and agent in these parts, lived in a fine brick house just out of the town, on the Mona Road, his family consisting of a wife and two daughters, brisk, lively young ladies with black hair and eyes, and very fine bright teeth, that shone whenever they laughed, and with a plenty to say for themselves. Thither Barnaby True was often asked to a family dinner, and, indeed, it was a pleasant home to visit, and to sit up on the veranda, and smoke a cigarro with the good old gentleman and look out toward the mountains, while the young ladies laughed and talked, or played upon the guitar and sang. And oftentimes so it was strongly upon Barnaby's mind to speak to the good gentleman, and tell him what he had beheld that night out in the harbor, but always he would think better of it, and hold his peace, falling to thinking, and smoking away upon his cigarro at a great rate. A day or two before the Belle Helen sailed from Kingston, Mr. Greenfield stopped Barnaby True as he was going through the office, to bid him to come to dinner that night, for there within the tropics they breakfast at 11 o'clock and take dinner in the cool of the evening, because of the heat, and not at midday, as we do in more temperate latitudes. I would have you meet, says Mr. Greenfield, your chief passenger for New York, and his granddaughter, for whom the state cabin and the two staterooms are to be fitted as he ordered, showing a letter, Sir John Malyoe and Miss Marjorie Malyoe. Did deliver here tell of Captain Jack Malyoe, Master Barnaby. Now I do believe that Mr. Greenfield had no notion at all that old Captain B.R., and was Barnaby True's own grandfather and Captain John Malyoe his murderer, but when he so thrusted him the name of that man, what with that in itself and the late adventure through which he himself had just passed, and with his brooding upon it until it was so prodigiously big in his mind, it was like hitting him a blow to, so fling the questions at him. Nevertheless, he was able to reply, with a pretty straight face, that he had heard of Captain Malyoe, and who he was. Well, says Mr. Greenfield, if Jack Malyoe was a desperate pirate, and a wild, reckless blade 20 years ago, why, he is Sir John Malyoe now, and the owner of a fine estate in Devonshire. Well, Master Barnaby, when one is a baronet, and come into the inheritance of a fine estate, though I do hear it is vastly cumbered with debts, the world will wink its eye to much that he may have done 20 years ago. I do hear say, though, that his own kin still turn the cold shoulder to him. To this address Barnaby answered nothing, but sat smoking away at his cigarro at a great rate. And so that night Barnaby True came face to face for the first time with the man who murdered his own grandfather, the greatest beast of a man that ever he met in all of his life. That time in the harbor he had seen Sir John Malyoe at a distance and in the darkness. Now that he beheld him nearby, it seemed to him that he had never looked at a more evil face in all his life. Not that the man was altogether ugly, for he had a good nose and a fine double chin, but his eyes stood out like balls, and were red and watery, and he winked them continually, as though they were always smarting, and his lips were thick and purple red, and his fat, red cheeks were mottled here and there with little clots of purple veins, and when he spoke his voice rattled so in his throat, that it made one wish to clear one's own throat to listen to him. So, what with a pair of fat, white hands, and that hoarse voice, and his swollen face, and his thick lips sticking out, it seemed to Barnaby True he had never seen a countenance so distasteful to him as that one into which he then looked. But if Sir John Malyoe was so displeasing to our hero's taste, why, the granddaughter, even this first time he beheld her, seemed to him to be the most beautiful, lovely young lady that ever he saw. As he had a thin, fair skin, red lips, and yellow hair, though it was then powdered pretty white for the occasion, and the bluest eyes that Barnaby beheld in all of his life. A sweet, timid creature, who seemed not to dare so much as to speak a word for herself without looking to Sir John for leave to do so, and would shrink and shudder whenever he would speak of a sudden to her, or direct a sudden glance upon her. When she did speak, it was in so low a voice that one had to bend his head to hear her, and even if she smiled, would catch herself and look up, as though to see if as he had leave to be cheerful. As for Sir John, he sat at dinner like a pig, and gobbled and ate and drank, smacking his lips all the while, but with hardly a word to either her, or Mrs. Greenfield, or to Barnaby True. But with a sour, sullen air, as though he would say, your damned victuals and drink are no better than they should be, but I must eat them or nothing. A great bloated beast of a man. Only after dinner was over and the young lady and the two misses sat off in a corner together did Barnaby hear her talk with any ease. Then, to be sure, her tongue became loose, and she prattled away at a great rate, though hardly above her breath, until of a sudden her grandfather called out, in his hoarse, rattling voice, that it was time to go. Whereupon she stopped short in what she was saying, and jumped up from her chair, looking as frightened as though as he had been caught in something amiss, and was to be punished for it. Barnaby True and Mr. Greenfield both went out to see the two into their coach, where Sir John's man stood holding the lantern. And who should he be, to be sure, but that same lean villain with bald head who had offered to shoot the leader of our hero's expedition out on the harbor that night. For one of the circles of light from the lantern shining up into his face, Barnaby True knew him the moment he clapped eyes upon him. Though he could not have recognized our hero, he grinned at him in the most impudent, familiar fashion, and never so much as touched his hat either to him, or to Mr. Greenfield. But as soon as his master and his young mistress had entered the coach, banged to the door and scrambled upon the seat alongside the driver, and so away without a word, but with another impudent grin, this time favoring both Barnaby and the old gentleman. Such were these two, master and man, and what Barnaby saw of them then was only confirmed by further observation, the most hateful couple he ever knew, though, God knows, what they afterward suffered, should wipe out all complaint against them. The next day Sir John Malyoe's belongings began to come aboard the Belle Helen, and in the afternoon that same lean, villainous manservant comes skipping across the gangplank as nimble as a goat, with two black men behind him lugging a great sea chest. "What?" he cried out, "and so you is the supercargo, is you? I thought you was more account, when I saw you last night a-sitting talking with his honor like his equal. Well, no matter. 'Tis something to have a brisk, genteel young fellow for a supercargo. So come, my hearty, lend a hand, will you, and help me set his honor's cabin to rights." What a speech was this to endure from such a fellow, to be sure! And Barnaby so high in his own esteem, and holding himself a gentleman. Well, what with his distaste for the villain, and what with such odious familiarity, you can guess into what temper so impudent an address must have cast him. "You'll find the steward in yonder," he said, "and he'll show you the cabin," and therewith turned and walked away with prodigious dignity, leaving the other standing where he was. As he entered his own cabin he could not but see, out of the tail of his eye, that the fellow was still standing where he had left him, regarding him with a most evil, malevolent countenance, so that he had the satisfaction of knowing that he had made one enemy during that voyage who was not very likely to forgive or forget what he must regard as a slight put upon him. The next day Sir John Malyoe himself came aboard, accompanied by his granddaughter, and followed by this man, and he followed again by four black men, who carried among them two trunks, not large in size, but prodigious heavy in weight, and toward which Sir John and his follower devoted the utmost solicitude and care to see that they were properly carried into the state cabin he was to occupy. Barnaby True was standing in the great cabin as they passed close by him, but though Sir John Malyoe looked hard at him, and straight in the face, he never so much as spoke a single word, or showed by a look or a sign, that he knew who our hero was. At this the serving man, who saw it all with eyes as quick as a cat's, fell to grinning and chuckling, to see Barnaby in his turn so slighted. The young lady, who also saw it all, flushed up red, then in the instant of passing looked straight at our hero, and bowed and smiled at him with a most sweet and gracious affability, then the next moment recovering herself, as though mightily frightened at what else he had done. The same day the Belle Helen sailed, with as beautiful, sweet weather as ever a body could wish for. There were only two other passengers aboard, the Reverend Simon Stiles, the master of a flourishing academy in Spanish Town, and his wife, a good, worthy old couple, but very quiet, and would sit in the great cabin by the hour together reading, so that, what with Sir John Malyoe staying all the time in his own cabin with those two trunks he held so precious, it fell upon Barnaby True in great part to show attention to the young lady, and glad enough he was of the opportunity, as anyone may guess. For when you consider a brisk, lively young man of 21 and a sweet, beautiful miss of 17 so thrown together day after day for 2 weeks, the weather being very fair, as I have said, and the ship tossing and bowling along before a fine humming breeze that sent white caps all over the sea, and with nothing to do but sit and look at that blue sea and the bright sky overhead, it is not hard to suppose what was to befall, and what pleasure it was to Barnaby True to show attention to her. But, oh, those days when a man is young, and, whether wisely or no, fallen in love. How often during that voyage did our hero lie awake in his berth at night, tossing this way and that without sleep, not that he wanted to sleep if he could, but would rather lie, so awake thinking about her, and staring into the darkness. Poor fool! He might have known that the end must come to such a fool's paradise before very long. For who was he to look up to Sir John Malyoe's granddaughter, he, the supercargo of a merchant ship, and she the granddaughter of a baronet? Nevertheless, things went along very smooth and pleasant, until one evening, when all came of a sudden to an end. At that time he and the young lady had been standing for a long while together, leaning over the rail and looking out across the water through the dusk toward the westward, where the sky was still of a lingering brightness. As he had been mightily quiet and dull all that evening, but now of a sudden she began, without any preface whatever, to tell Barnaby about herself and her affairs. She said that she and her grandfather were going to New York, that they might take passage thence to Boston Town, there to meet her cousin Captain Malyoe, who was stationed in garrison at that place. Then she went on to say that Captain Malyoe was the next heir to the Devonshire estate, and that she and he were to be married in the fall. But, poor Barnaby! What a fool was he, to be sure! She first began to speak about Captain Malyoe, he knew what was coming. But now that as he had told him, he could say nothing, but stood there staring across the ocean, his breath coming hot and dry as ashes in his throat. She, poor thing, went on to say, in a very low voice, that as he had liked him from the very first moment as he had seen him, and had been very happy for these days, and would always think of him as a dear friend who had been very kind to her, who had so little pleasure in life, and so would always remember him. Then they were both silent, until at last Barnaby made shift to say, though in a hoarse and croaking voice, that Captain Malyoe must be a very happy man, and that if he were in Captain Malyoe's place he would be the happiest man in the world. Thus, having spoken, and so found his tongue, he went on to tell her, with his head all in a whirl, that he, too, loved her, and that what she had told him struck him to the heart, and made him the most miserable, unhappy wretch in the whole world. She was not angry at what he said, nor did she turn to look at him, but only said, in a low voice, he should not talk so, for that it could only be a pain to them both to speak of such things, and that whether she would or no, she must do everything as her grandfather bade her, for that he was indeed a terrible man. To this poor Barnaby could only repeat, that he loved her with all his heart, that he had hoped for nothing in his love, but that he was now the most miserable man in the world. It was at this moment, so tragic for him, that someone who had been hiding nigh them all the while suddenly moved away, and Barnaby True could see in the gathering darkness, that it was that villain manservant of Sir John Malyoe's, and knew that he must have overheard all that had been said. The man went straight to the great cabin, and poor Barnaby, his brain all a-tingle, stood looking after him, feeling that now indeed the last drop of bitterness had been added to his trouble, to have such a wretch overhear what he had said. The young lady could not have seen the fellow, for she continued leaning over the rail, and Barnaby True, standing at her side, not moving, but in such a tumult of many passions, that he was like one bewildered, and his heart beating, as though to smother him. So they stood for I know not how long when, of a sudden, Sir John Malyoe comes running out of the cabin, without his hat, but carrying his gold-headed cane, and so straight across the deck to where Barnaby and the young lady stood, that spying wretch close at his heels, grinning like an imp. you hussy!" bawled out Sir John, so soon as he had come pretty near them, and in so loud a voice that all on deck might have heard the words. And as he spoke, he waved his cane back and forth, as though he would have struck the young lady, who, shrinking back almost upon the deck, crouched as though to escape such a blow. "You hussy! Here to be set down! What do you do here with this Yankee supercargo, not fit for a gentlewoman to wipe her feet upon? Get to your cabin, you hussy!" Only it was something worse he called her this time. "Before I lay this cane across your shoulders." What with the whirling of Barnaby's brains, and the passion into which he was already melted, what with his despair and his love, and his anger at this address, a man gone mad could scarcely be less accountable for his actions than was he at that moment. Hardly knowing what he did, he put his hand against Sir John Malyoe's breast, and thrust him violently back, crying out upon him in a great loud, hoarse voice for threatening a young lady, and saying that for a farthing he would wrench the stick out of his hand, and throw it overboard. Sir John went staggering back with the push Barnaby gave him, and then caught himself up again. Then, with a great bellow, ran roaring at our hero, whirling his cane about, and I do believe, would have struck him, and God knows then, what might have happened, had not his manservant caught him, and held him back. "Keep back!" cried out our hero, still mighty hoarse. "Back! If you strike me with that stick, I'll fling you overboard." By this time, what with the sound of loud voices and the stamping of feet, some of the crew and others aboard were hurrying up, and the next moment Captain Manly and the first mate, Mr. Freeston, came running out of the cabin. But Barnaby, who was by this fairly set a-going, could not now stop himself. "And who are you, anyhow?" he cried out, "to threaten to strike me, and to insult me, who am as good as you? You dare not strike me. You may shoot a man from behind, as you shot poor Captain Brand on the Rio Cobra River, but you won't dare strike me face to face. I know who you are, and what you are." By this time Sir John Malyoe had ceased to endeavor to strike him, but stood stock still, his great bulging eyes staring, as though they would pop out of his head. "What's all this?" cries Captain Manly, bustling up to them with Mr. Freeston. "What does all this mean?" But, as I have said, our hero was too far gone now to contain himself until all that he had to say was out. "The damned villain insulted me, and insulted the young lady," he cried out, panting in the extremity of his passion, "and then he threatened to strike me with his cane. But I know who he is, and what he is. I know what he's got in his cabin in those two trunks, and where he found it, and whom it belongs to. He found it on the shores of the Rio Cobra River, and I have only to open my mouth, and tell what I know about it." At this Captain Manly clapped his hand upon our hero's shoulder, and fell to shaking him, so that he could scarcely stand, calling out to him the while to be silent. "What do you mean? An officer of this ship to quarrel with a passenger of mine? Go straight to your cabin, and stay there till I give you leave to come out again." At this Master Barnaby came somewhat back to himself, and into his wits again with a jump. "But he threatened to strike me with his cane, Captain," he cried out, "and that I won't stand from any man." "No matter what he did," said Captain Manly, very sternly. "Go to your cabin, as I bid you, and stay there till I tell you to come out again, and when we get to New York I'll take pains to tell your stepfather of how you have behaved. I'll have no such rioting as this aboard my ship." Barnaby True looked around him, but the young lady was gone. Nor, in the blindness of his frenzy, had he seen whence he had gone nor whither she went. As for Sir John Malyoe, he stood in the light of a lantern, his face gone as white as ashes, and I do believe, if a look could kill, the dreadful malevolent stare he fixed upon Barnaby True would have slain him where he stood. After Captain Manly had so shaken some wits into poor Barnaby, he, unhappy wretch, went to his cabin, as he was bidden to do, and there, shutting the door upon himself, and flinging himself down, all dressed as he was, upon his birth, yielded himself over to the profoundest passion of humiliation and despair. There he lay for I know not how long, staring into the darkness, until by and by, in spite of his suffering and his despair, he dozed off into a loose sleep that was more like waking than sleep, being possessed continually by the most vivid and distasteful dreams, from which he would awaken, only to doze off and to dream again. It was from the midst of one of these extravagant dreams that he was suddenly aroused by the noise of a pistol shot, and then the noise of another, and then a great bump and a grinding jar, and then the sound of many footsteps running across the deck, and down into the great cabin. Then came a tremendous uproar of voices in the great cabin, the struggling as of men's bodies being tossed about, striking violently against the partitions and bulkheads. At the same instant, arose a screaming of women's voices, and one voice, and that Sir John Malyoe's, crying out as in the greatest extremity, "You villains! You damn villains!" And with the sudden detonation of a pistol fired into the close space of the great cabin, Barnaby was out in the middle of his cabin in a moment, and taking only time enough to snatch down one of the pistols that hung at the head of his berth, flung out into the great cabin, to find it as black as night, the lantern slung there having been either blown out or dashed out into darkness. The prodigiously dark space was full of uproar, the hubbub and confusion pierced through and through by that keen sound of women's voices screaming, one in the cabin and the other in the stateroom beyond. Almost immediately Barnaby pitched headlong over two or three struggling men scuffling together upon the deck, falling with a great clatter and the loss of his pistol, which, however, he regained almost immediately. What all the uproar meant he could not tell, but he presently heard Captain Manly's voice from somewhere suddenly calling out, "You bloody pirate, would you choke me to death?" Wherewith some notion of what had happened came to him like a dash, and that they had been attacked in the night by pirates. Looking toward the companionway, he saw, outlined against the darkness of the night without, the blacker form of a man's figure, standing still and motionless as a statue in the midst of all this hubbub, and so by some instinct he knew in a moment that that must be the master maker of all this devil's brew. Therewith, still kneeling upon the deck, he covered the bosom of that shadowy figure point-blank, as he thought, with his pistol, and instantly pulled the trigger. In the flash of red light, and in the instant stunning report of the pistol shot, Barnaby saw, as stamped upon the blackness, a broad, flat face with fishy eyes, a lean, bony forehead with what appeared to be a great blotch of blood upon the side, a cocked hat trimmed with gold lace, a red scarf across the breast, and the gleam of brass buttons. Then the darkness, very thick and black, swallowed everything again. But in the instant Sir John Malyoe called out, in a great loud voice, "Colin, my God! 'Tis William Brand! Of someone falling heavily down!" The next moment, Barnaby's sight coming back to him again in the darkness, he beheld that dark and motionless figure still standing exactly where it had stood before, and so knew either that he had missed it or else that it was of so supernatural a sort that a leaden bullet might do it no harm. Though if it was indeed an apparition that Barnaby beheld in that moment, there is this to say, that he saw it as plain as ever he saw a living man in all of his life. This was the last our hero knew, for the next moment somebody, whether by accident or design he never knew, struck him such a terrible violent blow upon the side of the head, that he saw 40,000 stars flash before his eyeballs, and then, with a great humming in his head, swooned dead away. When Barnaby True came back to his senses again, it was to find himself being cared for with great skill and nicety, his head bathed with cold water, and a bandage being bound about it as carefully as though a chirurgeon was attending to him. He could not immediately recall what had happened to him, nor until he had opened his eyes, to find himself in a strange cabin, extremely well fitted and painted with white and gold, the light of a lantern shining in his eyes, together with the gray of the early daylight through the dead dash eye. Two men were bending over him. One, a Negro in a striped shirt, with a yellow handkerchief around his head and silver earrings in his ears. The other, a white man, clad in a strange outlandish dress of a foreign make, and with great mustachios hanging down, and with gold earrings in his ears. It was the latter who was attending to Barnaby's hurt with such extreme care and gentleness. All this Barnaby saw with his first clear consciousness after his swoon. Then remembering what had befallen him, and his head beating, as though it would split asunder, he shut his eyes again, contriving with great effort to keep himself from groaning aloud, and wondering as to what sort of pirates these could be who would first knock a man in the head so terrible a blow as that which he had suffered, and then take such care to fetch him back to life again, and to make him easy and comfortable. Nor did he open his eyes again, but lay there gathering his wits together, and wondering thus until the bandage was properly tied about his head and sewed together. Then once more he opened his eyes, and looked up to ask where he was. Either they who were attending to him did not choose to reply, or else they could not speak English, for they made no answer, excepting by signs. For the white man, seeing that he was now able to speak, and so was come back into his senses again, nodded his head three or four times, and smiled with a grin of his white teeth, and then pointed, as though toward a saloon beyond. At the same time the Negro held up our hero's coat, and beckoned for him to put it on, so that Barnaby, seeing that it was required of him to meet someone without, arose, though with a good deal of effort, and permitted the Negro to help him on with his coat, still feeling mightily dizzy and uncertain upon his legs, his head beating fit to split, and the vessel rolling and pitching at a great rate, as though upon a heavy ground swell. So, still sick and dizzy, he went out into what was indeed a fine saloon beyond, painted in white and gilt like the cabin he had just quitted, and fitted in the nicest fashion, a mahogany table, polished very bright, extending the length of the room, and a quantity of bottles, together with glasses of clear crystal, arranged in a hanging rack above. Here at the table a man was sitting with his back to our hero, clad in a rough pea jacket, and with a red handkerchief tied around his throat, his feet stretched out before him, and he smoking a pipe of tobacco with all the ease and comfort in the world. As Barnaby came in he turned round, and, to the profound astonishment of our hero, presented toward him in the light of the lantern, the dawn shining pretty strong through the skylight, the face of that very man who had conducted the mysterious expedition that night across Kingston Harbor to the Rio Cobra River. This man looked steadily at Barnaby through for a moment or two, and then burst out laughing, and, indeed, Barnaby, standing there with the bandage about his head, must have looked a very droll picture of that astonishment he felt so profoundly at finding who was this pirate into whose hands he had fallen. "Well," says the other, "and so you be up at last, and no great harm done, I'll be bound. And how does your head feel by now, my young master?" To this Barnaby made no reply, but, what with wonder and the dizziness of his head, seated himself at the table over against the speaker, who pushed a bottle of rum toward him, together with a glass from the swinging shelf above. He watched Barnaby fill his glass, and so soon as he had done so began immediately by saying, "I do suppose you think you were treated mightily ill to be so handled last night. Well, so you were treated ill enough, though who hit you that crack up on the head I know no more than a child unborn. Well, I am sorry for the way you were handled, but there is this much to say, and of that you may believe me, that nothing was meant to you but kindness, and before you are through with us all you will believe that well enough." Here he helped himself to a taste of grog, and sucking in his lips, went on again with what he had to say. "Do you remember," said he, "that expedition of ours in Kingston Harbor, and how we were all of us balked that night? Why, yes, said Barnaby True, nor am I likely to forget it. And do you remember what I said to that villain, Jack Malio, that night as his boat went by us? As to that, said Barnaby True, I do not know that I can say yes or no, but if you will tell me, I will maybe answer you in kind. Why, I mean this, said the other. I said that the villain had got the better of us once again, but that next time it would be our turn, even if William Brand himself had to come back from hell, to put the business through. I remember something of the sort, said Barnaby, now that you speak of it, but still I am all in the dark, as to what you are driving at. The other looked at him very cunningly for a little while, his head on one side, and his eyes half shut. Then, as if satisfied, he suddenly burst out laughing. Look hither, said he, and I'll show you something, and therewith, moving to one side, disclosed a couple of traveling cases, or small trunks with brass studs, so exactly like those that Sir John Malio had fetched aboard at Jamaica that Barnaby, putting this and that together, knew that they must be the same. Our hero had a strong enough suspicion as to what those two cases contained, and his suspicions had become a certainty when he saw Sir John Malio struck all white at being threatened about them, and his face lowering so malevolently as to look murder had he dared do it. But, Lord, to what Barnaby True's two eyes beheld, when that man lifted the lids of the two cases, the locks thereof having already been forced, and, flinging back first one lid, and then the other, displayed to Barnaby's astonished sight a great treasure of gold and silver. Most of it tied up in leathern bags, to be sure, but many of the coins, big and little, yellow and white, lying loose and scattered about like so many beans, brimming the cases to the very top. Barnaby sat dumbstruck at what he beheld. As to whether he breathed or no, I cannot tell, but this I know, that he sat staring at that marvelous treasure like a man in a trance, until, after a few seconds of this golden display, the other banged down the lids again, and burst out laughing, whereupon he came back to himself with a jump. Well, and what do you think of that? Said the other. Enough for a man to turn pirate for? But, he continued, it is not for the sake of showing you this, that I have been waiting for you here so long a while, but to tell you, that you are not the only passenger aboard, but that there is another, whom I am to confide to your care and attention, according to orders I have received. So, if you are ready, Master Barnaby, I'll fetch her in directly. He waited for a moment, as though for Barnaby to speak, but our hero not replying, he arose, and, putting away the bottle of rum and the glasses, crossed the saloon to a door like that from which Barnaby had come a little while before. This he opened, and after a moment's delay and a few words spoken to someone within, ushered thence a young lady, who came out very slowly into the saloon, where Barnaby still sat at the table. It was Miss Marjorie Malio, very white, and looking as though stunned or bewildered by all that had befallen her. Barnaby True could never tell whether the amazing strange voyage that followed was of long or of short duration, whether it occupied 3 days or 10 days. For conceive, if you choose, two people of flesh and blood moving and living continually in all the circumstances and surroundings, as of a nightmare dream, yet they two so happy together that all the universe beside was of no moment to them. How was anyone to tell whether in such circumstances any time appeared to be long or short? Does a dream appear to be long or to be short? The vessel in which they sailed was a brigantine of good size and build, but manned by a considerable crew, the most strange and outlandish in their appearance that Barnaby had ever beheld, some white, some yellow, some black, and all tricked out with gay colors, and gold earrings in their ears, and some with great long mustachios, and others with handkerchiefs tied around their heads, and all talking a language together, of which Barnaby True could understand not a single word, but which might have been Portuguese from one or two phrases he caught. Nor did this strange, mysterious crew, of God knows what sort of men, seem to pay any attention whatever to Barnaby, or to the young lady. They might now and then have looked at him and her out of the corners of their yellow eyes, but that was all. Otherwise they were indeed like the creatures of a nightmare dream. Only he who was the captain of this outlandish crew would maybe speak to Barnaby a few words, as to the weather, or what not when he would come down into the saloon, to mix a glass of grog, or to light a pipe of tobacco, and then to go on deck again about his business. Otherwise our hero and the young lady were left to themselves, to do as they pleased, with no one to interfere with them. As for her, she at no time showed any great sign of terror or of fear, only for a little while was singularly numb and quiet, as though dazed with what had happened to her. Indeed, methinks that wild beast, her grandfather, had so crushed her spirit by his tyranny and his violence, that nothing that happened to her might seem sharp and keen, as it does to others of an ordinary sort. But this was only at first, for afterward her face began to grow singularly clear, as with a white light, and she would sit quite still, permitting Barnaby to gaze, I know not how long, into her eyes, her face so transfigured, and her lips smiling, and they, as it were, neither of them breathing, but hearing, as in another far distant place, the outlandish jargon of the crew talking together in the warm bright sunlight, or the sound of creaking block, and tackle as they hauled upon the sheets. Is it, then, any wonder that Barnaby True could never remember whether such a voyage as this was long or short? It was as though they might have sailed so upon that wonderful voyage forever. You may guess how amazed was Barnaby True when, coming upon deck one morning, he found the Brigantine riding upon an even keel, at anchor off Staten Island, a small village on the shore, and the well-known roofs and chimneys of New York Town in plain sight across the water. 'Twas the last place in the world he had expected to see. And, indeed, it did seem strange to lie there alongside Staten Island all that day, with New York Town so nigh at hand, and yet so impossible to reach. For whether he desired to escape or no, Barnaby True could not but observe that both he and the young lady were so closely watched that they might as well have been prisoners, tied hand and foot and laid in the hold, so far as any hope of getting away was concerned. All that day there was a deal of mysterious coming and going aboard the Brigantine, and in the afternoon a sailboat went up to the town, carrying the captain, and a great load covered over with a tarpaulin in the stern. What was so taken up to the town Barnaby did not then guess, but the boat did not return again till about sundown. For the sun was just dropping below the water, when the captain came aboard once more, and, finding Barnaby on deck, bade him come down into the saloon, where they found the young lady sitting, the broad light of the evening shining in through the skylight, and making it all pretty bright within. The captain commanded Barnaby to be seated, for he had something of moment to say to him, whereupon, as soon as Barnaby had taken his place alongside the young lady, he began very seriously, with a preface somewhat thus. Though you may think me the captain of this Brigantine, young gentleman, I am not really so, but am under orders, and so have only carried out those orders of a superior in all these things that I have done. Having so begun, he went on to say that there was one thing yet remaining for him to do, and that the greatest thing of all. He said that Barnaby and the young lady had not been fetched away from the Belle Helen as they were by any mere chance of accident, but that 'twas all a plan laid by a head wiser than his, and carried out by one whom he must obey in all things. He said that he hoped that both Barnaby and the young lady would perform willingly what they would be now called upon to do, but that whether they did it willingly or no, they must, for that those were the orders of one who was not to be disobeyed. You may guess how our hero held his breath at all this. But whatever might have been his expectations, the very wildest of them all did not reach to that which was demanded of him. My orders are these, said the other, continuing. I am to take you and the young lady ashore, and to see that you are married, before I quit you. And to that end a very good, decent, honest minister who lives ashore yonder in the village was chosen, and hath been spoken to and is now, no doubt, waiting for you to come. Such are my orders, and this is the last thing I am set to do. So now I will leave you alone together for 5 minutes to talk it over, but be quick about it, for whether willing or not, this thing must be done. Thereupon he went away, as he had promised, leaving those two alone together, Barnaby like one turned into stone, and the young lady, her face turned away, flaming as red as fire in the fading light. Nor can I tell what Barnaby said to her, nor what words he used, but only, all in a tumult, with neither beginning nor end he told her that God knew he loved her, and that with all his heart and soul, and that there was nothing in all the world for him but her. But, nevertheless, if she would not have it as had been ordered, and if she were not willing to marry him as she was bidden to do, he would rather die than lend himself to forcing her to do such a thing against her will. Nevertheless, he told her she must speak up, and tell him yes or no, and that God knew he would give all the world, if she would say yes. All this and more he said in such a tumult of words, that there was no order in their speaking, and she sitting there, her bosom rising and falling, as though her breath stifled her. Nor may I tell what she replied to him, only this, that she said she would marry him. At this he took her into his arms, and set his lips to hers, his heart all melting away in his bosom. So presently came the captain back into the saloon again, to find Barnaby sitting there holding her hand, she with her face turned away, and his heart beating like a trip hammer, and so saw that all was settled as he would have it. Wherewith he wished them both joy, and gave Barnaby his hand. The yawl boat belonging to the Briganton was ready and waiting alongside when they came upon deck, and immediately they descended to it, and took their seats. So they landed, and in a little while were walking up the village street in the darkness, she clinging to his arm, as though she would swoon, and the captain of the Briganton, and two other men from aboard following after them. And so to the minister's house, finding him waiting for them, smoking his pipe in the warm evening, and walking up and down in front of his own door. He immediately conducted them into the house, where, his wife having fetched a candle, and two others of the village folk being present, the good man having asked several questions, as to their names and their age, and where they were from, the ceremony was performed, and the certificate duly signed by those present, excepting the men who had come ashore from the Briganton, and who refused to set their hands to any paper. The same sailboat that had taken the captain up to the town in the afternoon was waiting for them at the landing place, whence, the captain, having wished them godspeed, and having shaken Barnaby very heartily by the hand, they pushed off, and, coming about, ran away with the slant of the wind, dropping the shore and those strange beings alike behind them into the night. As they sped away through the darkness they could hear the creaking of the sails, being hoisted aboard of the Briganton, and so knew that she was about to put to sea once more. Nor did Barnaby True ever set eyes upon those beings again, nor did anyone else, that I ever heard tell of. It was nigh midnight, when they made Mr. Hartwright's wharf at the foot of Wall Street, and so the streets were all dark and silent, and deserted as they walked up to Barnaby's home. You may conceive of the wonder and amazement of Barnaby's dear stepfather when, clad in a dressing gown and carrying a lighted candle in his hand, he unlocked and unbarred the door, and so saw who it was, had aroused him at such an hour of the night, and the young and beautiful lady whom Barnaby had fetched with him. The first thought of the good man was that the Belle Helen had come into port. Nor did Barnaby undeceive him as he led the way into the house, but waited until they were all safe and sound in privily together, before he should unfold his strange and wonderful story. This was left for you by two foreign sailors this afternoon, Barnaby, the good old man said, as he led the way through the hall, holding up the candle at the same time, so that Barnaby might see an object that stood against the wainscoting by the door of the dining room. Nor could Barnaby refrain from crying out with amazement when he saw that it was one of the two chests of treasure that Sir John Malyoe had fetched from Jamaica, and which the pirates had taken from the Belle Helen. As for Mr. Arkwright, he guessed no more what was in it than the man in the moon. The next day, but one brought the Belle Helen herself into port, with the terrible news, not only of having been attacked at night by pirates, but also that Sir John Malyoe was dead. For whether it was the sudden shock of the sight of his old captain's face, whom he himself had murdered and thought dead and buried, flashing so out against the darkness, or whether it was the strain of passion that overset his brains, certain it is that, when the pirates left the Belle Helen, carrying with them the young lady and Barnaby and the traveling trunks, those left aboard the Belle Helen found Sir John Malyoe lying in a fit upon the floor, frothing at the mouth and black in the face, as though he had been choked, and so took him away to his berth, where, the next morning about 10 o'clock, he died, without once having opened his eyes, or spoken a single word. As for the villain manservant, no one ever saw him afterward, though whether he jumped overboard, or whether the pirates who so attacked the ship had carried him away bodily, who shall say? Mr. Arkwright, after he had heard Barnaby's story, had been very uncertain as to the ownership of the chest of treasure that had been left by those men for Barnaby, but the news of the death of Sir John Malyoe made the matter very easy for him to decide. For surely if that treasure did not belong to Barnaby, there could be no doubt that it must belong to his wife, she being Sir John Malyoe's legal heir. And so it was that that great fortune, in actual computation amounting to upward of £63,000, came to Barnaby True, the grandson of that famous pirate, William Brand, the English estate in Devonshire, in default of male issue of Sir John Malyoe, descendant to Captain Malyoe, whom the young lady was to have married. As for the other case of treasure, it was never heard of again, nor could Barnaby ever guess whether it was divided as booty among the pirates, or whether they had carried it away with them to some strange and foreign land, there to share it among themselves. And so the ending of the story, with only this to observe, that whether that strange appearance of Captain Brand's face by the light of the pistol was a ghostly and spiritual appearance, or whether he was present in flesh and blood, there is only to say that he was never heard of again, nor had he ever been heard of till that time since the day he was so shot from behind by Captain John Malyoe on the banks of the Rio Cobra River in the year 1733. The second eye with the buccaneers, being an account of certain adventures that befell Henry Mostyn under Captain H. Although this narration has more particularly to do with the taking of the Spanish vice-admiral in the harbor of Portobello, and of the rescue therefrom of Le Sieur Simon, his wife and daughter, the adventure of which was successfully achieved by Captain Morgan, the famous buccaneer, we shall, nevertheless, premise something of the earlier history of Master Harry Mostyn, whom you may, if you please, consider as the hero of the several circumstances recounted in these pages. In the year 1664 our hero's father embarked from Portsmouth, in England, for the Barbados, where he owned a considerable sugar plantation. Thither to those parts of America he transported with himself his whole family, of whom our Master Harry was the fifth of 8 children, a great lusty fellow as little fitted for the church for which he was designed as could be. At the time of this story, though not above 16 years old, Master Harry Mostyn was as big and well grown as many a man of 20, and of such a reckless and daredevil spirit that no adventure was too dangerous or too mischievous for him to embark upon. At this time there was a deal of talk in those parts of the Americas concerning Captain Morgan and the prodigious successes he was having pirating against the Spaniards. This man had once been an indentured servant with Mr. Rolls, a sugar factor at the Barbados. Having served out his time, and being of lawless disposition, possessing also a prodigious appetite for adventure, he joined with others of his kidney, and, purchasing a caravel of 3 guns, embarked fairly upon that career of piracy the most successful that ever was heard of in the world. Master Harry had known this man very well, while he was still with Mr. Rolls, serving as a clerk at that gentleman's sugar wharf, a tall, broad-shouldered, strapping fellow, with red cheeks, and thick red lips, and rolling blue eyes, and hair as red as any chestnut. Many knew him for a bold, gruff, dash-spoken man, but no one at that time suspected that he had it in him to become so famous and renowned as he afterward grew to be. The fame of his exploits had been the talk of those parts for above a twelvemonth, when, in the latter part of the year 1665, Captain Morgan, having made a very successful expedition against the Spaniards into the Gulf of Campeche, where he took several important purchases from the Plate fleet, came to the Barbados, there to fit out another such venture, and to enlist recruits. He and certain other adventurers had purchased a vessel of some 500 tons, which they proposed to convert into a pirate, by cutting portholes for cannon, and running 3 or 4 carronades across her main deck. The name of this ship, be it mentioned, was the Good Samaritan, as ill-fitting a name as could be for such a craft, which, instead of being designed for the healing of wounds, was intended to inflict such devastation as those wicked men proposed. Here was a piece of mischief exactly fitted to our hero's tastes. Wherefore, having made up a bundle of clothes, and with not above a shilling in his pocket, he made an excursion into the town, to seek for Captain Morgan. There he found the great pirate established at an ordinary, with a little court of ragamuffins and swashbucklers gathered about him, all talking very loud, and drinking healths in raw rum, as though it were sugared water. And what a fine figure our buccaneer had grown, to be sure! How different from the poor, humble clerk upon the sugar wharf! What a deal of gold braid! What a fine, silver-hilted Spanish sword! What a gay velvet sling, hung with 3 silver-mounted pistols! If Master Harry's mind had not been made up before, to be sure such a spectacle of glory would have determined it. This figure of war our hero asked to step aside with him, and when they had come into a corner, proposed to the other what he intended, and that he had a mind to enlist as a gentleman adventurer upon this expedition. Upon this our rogue of a buccaneer captain burst out a-laughing, and fetching Master Harry a great thump upon the back, swore roundly that he would make a man of him, and that it was a pity to make a parson out of so good a piece of stuff. Nor was Captain Morgan less good than his word, for when the Good Samaritan set sail with a favoring wind for the island of Jamaica, Master Harry found himself established as one of the adventurers aboard. The second could do but have seen the town of Port Royal as it appeared in the year 1665, he would have beheld a sight very well worthwhile looking upon. There were no fine houses at that time, and no great counting houses built of brick, such as you may find nowadays, but a crowd of board and wattled huts huddled along the streets, and also gay with flags and bits of color, that Vanity Fair itself could not have been gayer. To this place came all the pirates and buccaneers that infested those parts, and men shouted, and swore and gambled, and poured out money like water, and then maybe wound up their merrymaking by dying of fever. For the sky in these torrid latitudes is all full of clouds overhead, and as hot as any blanket, and when the sun shone forth it streamed down upon the smoking sands, so that the houses were ovens and the streets were furnaces. So it was little wonder that men died like rats in a hole. But little they appeared to care for that, so that everywhere you might behold a multitude of painted women and Jews and merchants and pirates, gaudy with red scarfs and gold braid, and all sorts of odds and ends of foolish finery, all fighting and gambling and bartering for that ill-gotten treasure of the be-robbed Spaniard. Here, arriving, Captain Morgan found a hearty welcome, and a message from the governor awaiting him, the message bidding him attend His Excellency upon the earliest occasion that offered. Whereupon, taking our hero, of whom he had grown prodigiously fond, along with him, our pirate went, without any loss of time, to visit Sir Thomas Modiford, who was then the royal governor of all this devil's brew of wickedness. They found His Excellency seated in a great easy chair, under the shadow of a slatted veranda, the floor whereof was paved with brick. He was clad, for the sake of coolness, only in his shirt, breeches, and stockings, and he wore slippers on his feet. He was smoking a great cigarro of tobacco, and a goblet of lime juice and water and rum stood at his elbow on a table. Here, out of the glare of the heat, it was all very cool and pleasant, with a sea breeze blowing violently in through the slats, setting them rattling now and then, and stirring Sir Thomas's long hair, which he had pushed back for the sake of coolness. The purport of this interview, I may tell you, concerned the rescue of one Le Sieur Simon, who, together with his wife and daughter, was held captive by the Spaniards. This gentleman adventurer, Le Sieur Simon, had, a few years before, been set up by the buccaneers as governor of the island of Santa Catarina. This place, though well fortified by the Spaniards, the buccaneers had seized upon, establishing themselves thereon, and so infesting the commerce of those seas, that no Spanish fleet was safe from them. At last the Spaniards, no longer able to endure these assaults against their commerce, sent a great force against the freebooters, to drive them out of their island stronghold. This they did, retaking Santa Catarina, together with its governor, his wife, and daughter, as well as the whole garrison of buccaneers. This garrison was sent by their conquerors, some to the galleys, some to the mines, some to no man knows where. The governor himself, Le Sieur Simon, was to be sent to Spain, there to stand his trial for piracy. The news of all this, I may tell you, had only just been received in Jamaica, having been brought thither by a Spanish captain, one Don Roderigo Silvia, who was, besides, the bearer of dispatches to the Spanish authorities relating the whole affair. Such, in fine, was the purport of this interview, and as our hero and his captain walked back together from the governor's house to the ordinary, where they had taken up their inn, the buccaneer assured his companion that he purposed to obtain those dispatches from the Spanish captain that very afternoon, even if he had to use force to seize them. All this, you are to understand, was undertaken only because of the friendship that the governor and Captain Morgan entertained for Le Sieur Simon. And, indeed, it was wonderful how honest and how faithful were these wicked men in their dealings with one another. For you must know that Governor Modiford and Le Sieur Simon and the buccaneers were all of one kidney, all taking a share in the piracies of those times, and all holding by one another, as though they were the honestest men in the world. Hence it was they were also determined to rescue Le Sieur Simon from the Spaniards. Having reached his ordinary after his interview with the governor, Captain Morgan found there a number of his companions, such as usually gathered at that place to be in attendance upon him, some, those belonging to the Good Samaritan, others, those who hoped to obtain benefits from him, others, those ragamuffins who gathered around him, because he was famous, and because it pleased them to be of his court, and to be called his followers. For nearly all was your successful pirate at such a little court surrounding him. Finding a dozen or more of these rascals gathered there, Captain Morgan informed them of his present purpose, that he was going to find the Spanish captain to demand his papers of him, and calling upon them to accompany him. With this following at his heels, our buccaneer started off down the street, his lieutenant, a Cornishman named Bartholomew Davis, upon one hand and our hero upon the other. So they paraded the streets for the best part of an hour before they found the Spanish captain. For whether he had got wind that Captain Morgan was searching for him, or whether, finding himself in a place so full of his enemies, he had buried himself in some place of hiding, it is certain that the buccaneers had traversed pretty nearly the whole town before they discovered that he was lying at a certain auberge kept by a Portuguese Jew. Thither they went, and thither Captain Morgan entered with the utmost coolness and composure of demeanor, his followers crowding noisily in at his heels. The space within was very dark, being lighted only by the doorway, and by two large slatted windows or openings in the front. In this dark, hot place, not over roomy at the best, were gathered 12 or 15 villainous appearing men, sitting at tables and drinking together, waited upon by the Jew and his wife. Our hero had no trouble in discovering which of this lot of men was Captain Sylvia, for not only did Captain Morgan direct his glance full of war upon him, but the Spaniard was clad with more particularity, and with more show of finery than any of the others who were there. Him Captain Morgan approached, and demanded his papers, whereunto the other replied with such a jabber of Spanish and English, that no man could have understood what he said. To this Captain Morgan in turn, replied that he must have those papers, no matter what it might cost him to obtain them, and thereupon drew a pistol from his sling, and presented it at the other's head. At this threatening act yon the innkeeper's wife fell a-screaming, and the Jew, as in a frenzy, besought them not to tear the house down about his ears. Our hero could hardly tell what followed, only that all of a sudden there was a prodigious uproar of combat. Knives flashed everywhere, and then a pistol was fired so close to his head that he stood like one stunned, hearing someone crying out in a loud voice, but not knowing whether it was a friend or a foe who had been shot. Then another pistol shot so deafened what was left of Master Harry's hearing that his ears rang for above an hour afterward. By this time the whole place was full of gunpowder smoke, and there was the sound of blows and oaths and outcrying, and the clashing of knives. As Master Harry, who had no great stomach for such a combat, and no very particular interest in the quarrel, was making for the door, a little Portuguese, as withered and as nimble as an ape, came ducking under the table and plunged at his stomach with a great long knife, which, had it effected its object, would surely have ended his adventures then and there. Finding himself in such danger, Master Harry snatched up a heavy chair, and, flinging it at his enemy, who was preparing for another attack, he fairly ran for it out of the door, expecting every instant to feel the thrust of the blade betwixt his ribs. A considerable crowd had gathered outside, and others, hearing the uproar, were coming running to join them. With these our hero stood, trembling like a leaf, and with cold chills running up and down his back like water at the narrow escape from the danger that had threatened him. Nor shall you think him a coward, for you must remember he was hardly 16 years old at the time, and that this was the first affair of the sort he had encountered. Afterward, as you shall learn, he showed that he could exhibit courage enough at a pinch. While he stood there, endeavoring to recover his composure, the while the tumult continued within, suddenly two men came running almost together out of the door, a crowd of the combatants at their heels. The first of these men was Captain Sylvia. The other, who was pursuing him, was Captain Morgan. As the crowd about the door parted before the sudden appearing of these, the Spanish captain, perceiving, as he supposed, a way of escape open to him, darted across the street with incredible swiftness toward an alleyway upon the other side. Upon this, seeing his prey like to get away from him, Captain Morgan snatched a pistol out of his sling, and resting it for an instant across his arm, fired at the flying Spaniard, and that with so true an aim that, though the street was now full of people, the other went tumbling over and over all of a heap in the kennel, where he lay, after a twitch or two, as still as a log. At the sound of the shot, and the fall of the man, the crowd scattered upon all sides, yelling and screaming, and the street being thus pretty clear, Captain Morgan ran across the way to where his victim lay, his smoking pistol still in his hand, and our hero following close at his heels. Our poor Harry had never before beheld a man killed thus in an instant who a moment before had been so full of life and activity, for when Captain Morgan turned the body over upon its back he could perceive at a glance, little as he knew of such matters, that the man was stone dead. And, indeed, it was a dreadful sight for him who was hardly more than a child. He stood rooted for he knew not how long, staring down at the dead face with twitching fingers and shuddering limbs. Meantime a great crowd was gathering about them again. As for Captain Morgan, he went about his work with the utmost coolness and deliberation imaginable, unbuttoning the waistcoat and the shirt of the man he had murdered with fingers that neither twitched nor shook. There were a gold cross and a bunch of silver medals hung by a whipcord about the neck of the dead man. This Captain Morgan broke away with a snap, reaching the jingling baubles to Harry, who took them in his nerveless hand and fingers, that he could hardly close upon what they held. The papers Captain Morgan found in a wallet in an inner breast pocket of the Spaniard's waistcoat. These he examined one by one, and finding them to his satisfaction, tied them up again, and slipped the wallet and its contents into his own pocket. Then for the first time he appeared to observe Master Harry, who, indeed, must have been standing, the perfect picture of horror and dismay. Whereupon, bursting out a-laughing, and slipping the pistol he had used back into its sling again, he fetched poor Harry a great slap upon the back, bidding him be a man, for that he would see many such sights as this. But indeed, it was no laughing matter for poor Master Harry, for it was many a day before his imagination could rid itself of the image of the dead Spaniard's face. And as he walked away down the street with his companions, leaving the crowd behind them, and the dead body, where it lay for its friends to look after, his ears humming and ringing from the deafening noise of the pistol shots fired in the close room, and the sweat trickling down his face in drops, he knew not whether all that had passed had been real, or whether it was a dream from which he might presently awaken. The Book of Pirates.